Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Health and Social Services meeting to order at 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, February 17th. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones. Committee members present are Senator Reinbolt, Senator Costello, Senator Hughes, and Senator Baggage, and myself, Senator Wilson. We have a quorum to conduct business. This afternoon, we have two items of business. We have two appointees to the State Medical Board. And then we'll hear take introduction from them and take invite testimony of Senate Bill 184 from Senator Baggage, Settlement, Trust, and Benefits Eligibility. First on the list for testifying, we have Dr. Matt, and I'm going to apologize for if I mispronounce your last name. Is it Halalala?
Yeah, that's fine. Halala. Halala. Yeah. Either way.
All right. Well, Dr. Matt, if you could introduce yourself and put your name on the record, give us a quick introduction of yourself, tell us if you're being appointed to a particular seat on the board, and tell us with when your board expires.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Wilson. As you stated, my name is Matt Halala. I am from Soldot, Alaska, originally. And I was appointed by the governor to sit in one of the vacant physician seats on the state medical board. I find it to be quite an honor, and I'm happy to be here presenting to you. I hope each of the members received a copy of my introductory letter. I don't want to repeat all the things I said there, but I am a podiatric physician and surgeon, so that's a foot and ankle surgeon. I've been in practice in Alaska and Anchorage and Wasilla for nearly 25 years. And I've been deeply immersed in the medical community, in the outpatient and inpatient realm. In that whole time, I've, kind of gotten to know most of the, individuals, around South Central Alaska anyways. And, I find it to be a really great opportunity to serve my fellow Alaskans and, yeah, I think it's a unique time, and I would be the first podiatric physician and surgeon on the board, although we're governed by the state medical board as such. So I think it's a neat opportunity to represent my subspecialty, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions. And again, it's an honor to be here, and I'm very pleased that the governor appointed me.
All right. Do we have questions? Senator Reinbolt.
And thank you for being willing to serve. And it's pretty neat, you know, to be the first from your area to be on this board. This board is probably one of the most important boards, I think, at this time under this COVID-19 crisis. So I've got three questions for you. I'm going to just go ahead and list them all, and then you can respond. If you need me to repeat, let me know. But one, I want to know your position on a patient advocate in the hospital. I want to know your opinion in regards to non-discrimination of healthcare based on the COVID-19 vax status, and then the patient-doctor relationship to be able to prescribe off-label products. Those are my three key issues. So I don't want the pharmacist to be able to, when a patient and a doctor or a provider makes a decision for them to use, let's just say, ivermectin, I don't think it's right for a pharmacist to decline to fill that script. So that's where I'm going with that one. So if once again, patient advocacy in hospitals, I think every patient deserves a patient advocate, and the non-discrimination based on COVID status for any reason and the ability to decline, and then the patient-doctor relationship in regards to off-label medications. Thank you.
Okay. Forgive me if I don't completely understand the context of the first one. The patient advocacy in the hospital, I think that, I think one of the things that's really important to communicate to patients, from a standpoint of inpatient or outpatient care is the importance of advocating for oneself, and if they're not able to have family members that are allowed and authorized to be advocates for them and to be listened to and within the constraints and confines of the staff membership as it pertains to inpatient care, to have a choice of which physician they're being treated by. So I mean, that's critically important patient advocacy. And, you know, I would suppose as it pertains to COVID treatments in the hospital, it can be a bit convoluted with regards to what's, you know, what medications are on the formulary and formulary of the hospital. But I think it needs to be left, you know, to the medical staff, the governing bodies of the hospital, and to try not to be too interfering of what the treating physicians and families feel is their best treatment choice. I think that my approach would be to, when in doubt, defer to physicians and families and patients, rather than overriding with strict, you know, top-down type rules and things. So I'm certainly feel like patient advocacy is critical. So in the second question was the non-discriminating. Could you repeat that second question for me?
Sure. Many across the nation and a lot in Alaska are saying they're being basically pushed, the COVID vaccine is being pushed so hard that they're not getting the treatment that they normally would have be getting if they had the vaccine status. So I have a bill for non-discrimination based on the COVID-19 vaccine for any reason, no, not being denied benefits, et cetera. Someone actually wants me to put an amendment in to make sure that no health care is denied either. That was an issue that I had not thought of. But
no, I think – I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I couldn't imagine a rationale where just because someone's not vaccinated or they are vaccinated that they would be eligible or not eligible. I know it becomes very complicated with like organ transplantation. That was in the news where someone was in line for, I believe, a lung or a heart transplant. And they had created a criteria that if they were not vaccinated, they were not going to be able to be a recipient for that. That might be beyond my ability to really ascertain the appropriateness. But as far as patients approaching the hospital in distress from COVID, I know that there was a lot of talk, and it was kind of politicized about whether or not these people deserve the attention of their physicians, et cetera. I think that's a terrible slippery slope. What about people? Because of course, getting vaccinated is right now a choice, and it's a behavioral choice. When we're looking at public health in general, you know, our behaviors dictate our health largely. You know, whether we're obese, whether we're smokers, whether we're drinkers, you know, whatever activities we insist on, you know, participating in that places at risk of health problems, broken bones, et cetera. And I would, you know, stand strong against the concept that we start parsing care out to people based upon them behaving or you know, or right now getting vaccinated or not. So I would feel that that would be a real slippery slope. And as far as pharmacists overriding prescriptions written by physicians for their patients, just because it's not FDA approved, that's not a precedent that we've actually had in our country, that if something's not FDA approved, that it can't be prescribed. I've seen statistics anywhere from as many as 70% to 80% of medications written in certain timeframes are non-FDA approved treatments. Many medications don't ever go through the FDA approval process, which is very laborious, time intensive, and very costly. And yet standard of care has dictated that many of these medications that are not FDA approved are the preferred treatment. So I think that was a bit disconcerting to have pharmacists. It sounded as if they were being pressured by their corporations, whether it be CVS, CVX, or a lot of these other chain pharmacies. If they were making these big top-down policies. It's a unique time. I think there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of pressure from all directions for people. And I think people need to be patient with each other. I think that there's certainly been some blowback back to the pharmacists that were participating in that and blowback to the pharmacies. And I think they're probably, have some accountability in that regard as time goes by. I did see that as a problem that the pharmacists were kind of taking it upon themselves, or the pharmacies upon themselves, to say that patients could not receive otherwise readily available, very cheap, and largely very safe medications for, treatments of which they disagreed. So I didn't see any real strong rationale for that.
All right.
Can I make sure I understood what he said? I just wanted to reiterate what he said.
That's fine.
Okay. And thank you. And I think it's Dr. Halala. Thank you very much. So I just want to say I've had many listening sessions, and many do believe that their loved ones died because of lack of early intervention and lack of available products. So that's a really critical issue, and I can't tell you how many doctors I've talked to. Even my own pharmacist in Eagle River was denying filling the script, which I thought was absolutely outrageous. I won't go to that pharmacy any longer. But so I just want to make sure I heard you clearly. Yes, you advocate for a patient and a patient advocate in the hospital. Number two, you do not want discrimination based on COVID vaccine status. And three, you do not believe in a pharmacy overruling a patient-physician prescription. Is that accurate?
That I think that we could generally say yes. Of course, there's exceptions to those things, of course. But yes, you heard me correctly.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Costello, then Senator Baggage. Okay, Senator Baggage.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, Doctor. And the first one, though, is just a follow-on to the question I just heard asked. And if you wouldn't support the medical board establishing a policy to force a pharmacist to act against their professional desire to determine who should or shouldn't receive a prescription, would you? Let me elaborate for a moment. Senator Reinbold indicated she no longer plans to go to that pharmacy. That's her choice. And she shouldn't have to go to a pharmacy that doesn't practice the way that she wants practices to occur. I don't go to doctors. I've changed my doctor twice because I haven't liked the way they practice medicine with me. That's a choice I have. A pharmacist is a person in business for themselves. They have professional degrees and certifications in what they do. If they decide that their opinion is that they don't want, based on their medical knowledge, that they shouldn't provide a prescription, would you want to force them to do so?
I would say that's a great question. And I think it's a great question because of the current circumstances in particular, but it would need to be applied broadly. And one of the things I've learned, I've been on the board functioning, even though I've not been confirmed yet, by the legislative body. And Dr. Wien, the director, is teaching us what's under the purview of the board, which I think is critically important to keep that in mind. So I'm not sure that something like that would be under the purview of the board. I know as a practicing surgeon, we've become confronted with this idea that the pharmacists are having a lot more say in our prescribing practices, and that's being rooted out of the opioid crisis primarily, where there's really strict parameters of, how much opioid you can prescribe to any one patient. It's obviously for good reason being much more regulated, and it's being more heavily scrutinized. So we're getting pharmacists calling us back saying, hey, you wrote for 16, pain pills, and for this patient, we think it's more appropriate to, only prescribe 14 pain pills. So it's a little bit frustrating from the side of providers to be told that well, you know, it's a post-operative, you know, short-duration opioid medication, and this is the exact guideline that we want you to abide. Now, with the opioids, it's understandable. And with other medications, there probably will naturally be pushback from providers that, hey, wait a minute, you don't understand why I'm writing this, right? So I think that it needs to be looked at. If it comes up that there would be some kind of an idea that pharmacies or pharmacists would not be allowed either by state, you know, and I'm sure it would be different state by state. That would need to be debated, looked at pretty heavily, because again, it's already happening with opioids, and I think the nation decided that's probably fine to have a little bit of additional oversight with regards to that, because the opioid thing clearly got out of hand nationally. But with other medications and things, I don't think we've risen to that threshold yet. But I guess I would say I'd have an open mind to that. But I do like the freedom of providers and physicians if they meet general criteria of safety, you know, and that the medication is not terribly scarce, like it needs to be conserved for certain critical patients, et cetera. But that's a really tough question.
Doctor, we're going to ask you to, if you could more concisely put your questions, answer the questions because of our time constraints.
Right.
But Senator Begich has another question for you.
Yeah, I just wanted to say you've described a dialogue, and I think that's the right approach. But you've said something else that I think is worth the committee noting, which is the purview of the medical board really doesn't get into that area. And what it does get into is disciplinary processes and disciplinary actions. And so are you comfortable? And have you been involved in the past? You've mentioned you've been on serving on the board in an unconfirmed role so far. But are you comfortable and involved in the process that requires you to apply state statute and regulation to those who potentially may need a disciplinary action for violations of either the statutes or regulations? Are you comfortable in that role? And have you been found yourself having to conduct that role?
Yes, I am very comfortable in that role, and it's a learning process for everybody that serves, and with the assistance of the investigators, that I found it to be something that I am well suited to.
Thank you very much for that answer, and thank you for the other answer as well. Dr. Wien has given you good advice to focus on what is the purview of the medical board.
Thank you, Senator Casella.
Thank you, and I do want to also say that each of these boards and commissions that we all review, and I am chair of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and just yesterday we talked to an applicant to the Board of Pharmacy. I do think it's very important that we look to the statutes and what the board's purview is, and also the seat that is being filled, and not add our own, individual criteria, because it is essentially written out in statute. Since you're online, first of all, I want to say thank you for putting yourself out there to serve on this board, and I want to mention that I now serve on the Life Alaska board, and I noticed that you did for a period of time and also have done a lot of different things giving back to your community, and I really do appreciate that. My question is, I'm curious to know from your standpoint if you can – tell me if I'm under the correct understanding of how things work. It's my understanding that when a person goes to the doctor, they are a patient. And then when they take that prescription to the pharmacy, they at that point are a customer. And I have never understood this concept that the pharmacist can have prescribing authority or second guess a doctor's prescription when the doctor has done the examination, the doctor's gone to school, has a medical degree. That's a private decision. And I just wanted to know if that's how you see it too. Do you see the individual Alaskan as a customer when they go to the pharmacy?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it is somewhat of a new concept. Again, I think it's because of the opioid crisis. Where there was a lot of finger pointing of, you know, at what level a check and balance not occur? And ideally, the way we've traditionally looked at pharmacists as somebody that does provide guidance, but that they respect the prescribing physician's order. And unless there's some unusual circumstance, like, hey, did you realize there was an allergy, et cetera, the culture of healthcare with the physician side, the provider side, is that the pharmacist is acting more as a provider of a service and products through the company. I think it's evolved because there used to be like neighborhood pharmacists that maybe provided more guidance and had more of a relationship with their patients. But so ideally, I think that the way it's set up now, it is most often that the physician is the one, of course, making the medical decisions and coming up with the treatment plan, and it's expected that the pharmacist would help facilitate that treatment plan. And in rare instances, raise a red flag if there's an issue there. But so that's kind of my persistent viewpoint of the way a pharmacist fits in the modern system, that they're not really a part of.
Dr. Matt. We're going to go on to the next question here, Senator Rival, okay. And then we got to get to our next appointee.
Okay. So when I said that we believe in regards to a patient advocate in the hospitals with the patient, the non-discrimination of COVID vaccine status based on providing of care, and then the patient-physician relationship, you said in general you agree with that, but there are exceptions. I think you described the exceptions in the scheduled drugs, and I agree. If we take off the scheduled drugs, just push that off of the table, about 35% of the time, prescriptions are used off-label as it is. So I loved Senator Costello's question in regards to a pharmacist. If there's a patient and a doctor, they have talked about everything. The doctor has obtained informed consent from the patient that they want this product. It sounds like you don't agree with a pharmacist basically superseding, and they don't. I don't even know if they have malpractice insurance or anything, but superseding that prescription in general. And let's say it's ivermectin, like even the NIH had ivermectin as approval for a COVID treatment. And then a lot of people do believe that their family members died, and I actually agree with them from what the knowledge that I have, that could have easily happened within the hospitals. But in general, you support the doctor-physician relationship, and that the pharmacist's role primarily is to just fill the prescription. Is that correct?
Yes. In general, yes. I would agree with that. I know that there's a lot of, details on the other side of the argument that I've not been privy to. But yes, no, I generally agree with that. And again, sometimes hospitals have formularies where they have reasons why they don't offer certain medications in-house. But my default would be not to interfere with the credentialed on-staff physician caring for the patient.
Final question.
Quick question.
Okay,
yes.
I was in pharmaceuticals for years, and trust me, I know what it's like to get medications on formularies. I get it, but I also believe that it's absolutely critically important for the patients to have advocacy, and if there is a product that's not on the formula, you should have access to it. But what my question is, do you agree to not politically target physicians that are practicing medication? My sister, Dr. Farr, was one of them, that she was having tremendous success using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. She was targeted. Do you agree not to be part of political targeting based on maybe something that's not what the CDC necessarily is pushing, or the most popular at the time, even though it's very effective and it works? So I just think it's very important to not use boards as political weapons.
Correct. I think that targeting of physicians, patients, facilities is counterproductive for sure. So, just in full disclosure, I know your sister. I have appreciated her as a peer in the community for years. And I respect her position. As myself, I remain a little bit neutral about the efficacious treatments, but I don't like the targeting. I think it's...
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Helena. At this time, we're going to go into public testimony on your conferee. Is anyone here in the room? Open public testimony. Is anyone here in the room in Juneau like to... Seeing none, we'll go to the phone lines. If there's no one online. And that's where we'll move on to. We just want to thank you for your time, but we do need to continue on with our agenda today. Our next, we'll move on to Captain David Wilson. And this is not the Captain David Wilson from Palmer, who's also a Alaska State Trooper, nor is it the Senator from Wasilla. This is a separate Captain David Wilson that we have before us. So, Mr. Wilson, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon.
You may know the drill. If you could, this is also a board appointee for the State Medical Board. If you can state which seats you are filling, the term, if you are, this is a reappointment or not, and go into your reasons of why you would like to serve on the State Medical Board and put yourself on the record, please.
Right. My name is Dave Wilson, and I've applied for the vacant public position. This is an initial appointment and not a reappointment. And allow me to just introduce myself. I'm a captain, a 737 captain for Alaska Airlines. I routinely fly in and out of Juneau and have likely had the pleasure of having many of you on one of my flights. I moved to Kodiak, Alaska in April of 1987, and it was supposed to be just for the summer. I just finished up my sophomore year in college, and I was planning on getting a job commercial fishing and then head back to school. As it turns out, I'm not a very good fisherman, but I like the town of Kodiak, and so I decided to stay for the winter. Right away, I recognized that in order to get around this great state requires either a boat or an airplane. And so I began pursuing a career in aviation. I went back to the lower 48 for a few years to complete my flight training, and then came back in the spring of 1993 to fly for a company called Mark Air Express. Since then, I've been flying commercially in the state, throughout the U.S. and internationally for almost 30 years now. I've been assigned direct supervisory roles over all aspects of flight operations, training, recruitment, safety, regulatory compliance, and accident investigations. Also, I have provided extensive consulting services to the State of Alaska Department of Public Safety, Department of Transportation, and a number of other organizations. Currently, in addition to flying the 737 for Alaska Airlines, I work with our fleet technologies and performance team to develop procedures that allow us to fly safely and reliably in and out of Juneau in adverse weather when no one else is able to. And finally, I serve as the Anchorage chair of the Professional Standards Board. Now allow me to step back for just a moment and explain my interest in the State Medical Board. After Mark Air folded in 1995, I had the opportunity to return to Kodiak and fly for Penn Air. This was a fantastic experience. I was able to really connect with many of the rural Alaska Native communities, including many of the doctors and medical professionals that serve those communities. I forged friendships with some of the most caring and dedicated individuals I have ever met during the following years. The doctors and nurses I flew around Kodiak consistently demonstrated an incredible level of compassion and personal interest in the local residents. My family moved to Palmer in 2000, and my family continued to benefit from amazing care from our local physicians. Our family doctor, who has since retired, would occasionally call me at home to check on the kids after we had been in to see them. Recently, my father passed away after a long and arduous battle with dementia. Unfortunately, we were able to care for him at home until he died. I personally oversaw every aspect of his care, and through his process, I was able to work with some of the finest, most compassionate physicians and nurses in the state. My interest in serving on the state medical board is to somehow give back to this great medical community.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Senator Reinbold.
I believe I should be calling you Captain Wilson. Captain.
Please, no, okay. Dave is good.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for getting people to and from everywhere you fly safely. You've been doing it for many years in very interesting territory. So good job. Good job on that. Thanks for your willingness to serve as well. I think you heard my questions. One, I think there should be a patient advocate with patients in the hospitals right now. They're bound from that. So I think you heard my questions before. I want to know your opinion on that. Number two, no discrimination based on the COVID-19 vax status. And I know that Governor Dunleavy has an executive order to not allow immunity passports based on the COVID-19. So it all goes together. And then third, what your opinion would be on the patient physician or provider relationship, and whether pharmacy should be able to trump that after informed consent was achieved with the patient. So I think you heard the three questions before, and I think you've got broader experience now that you've had saw your family through some really challenging times, and I think you have a real pure heart for serving. So if you could just touch bases on those, I'd really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. First of all, Your sister, Ilona Farr, is my wife's doctor.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
She's amazing. I wrote a letter in defense of Dr. Farr for early treatment of COVID, and so I think that should stand on its own. I definitely defend early treatment, and so. I think that there is not enough information and data out there. I'm not anti-vax at all, but I also am a strong advocate for freedom of decision and choices with regards to our body. So I think that addresses that question, and if I need to clarify, please say so. As far as an advocate, my dad, over the last several years, he was not, the dementia took a terrible toll on him, and there was absolutely no way that he could speak for himself with regards to his medical care. So he absolutely had to have an advocate, and I was proud to be that for him. And so I believe that there's a lot of cases that support the importance of an advocate in the medical system. When you're in the hospital, sometimes you're under pain medication and so on, which alters your decision-making ability. And so I think having a clear, lucid-thinking family member or advocate there is really important. And then the final issue with the pharmacy is, I agree that the pharmacy, we're a customer of the pharmacy and of the pharmacist. And when we go in to see the pharmacist, we don't fill out that medical history like we do when we go see the doctor, And when we go in to see the doctor, there's a lot of trust that is employed, and we talk about a history and allergies and adverse reactions, and all of those things are taken into consideration with the physician before they prescribe something. And so all of those things are taken into consideration when that prescription is written. The pharmacy does not have the benefit of any of that information. And so I doubt that they would be able to make an intelligent judgment on whether or not a particular medication is appropriate for you, because they don't have the backstory on any of that. So that is my position on those three.
And thank you. I think those were excellent answers, and I'm very appreciative. I wanted to just make sure that I got on a record with you, and I want to know if you agree. I just am concerned about collusion between big pharma and big corporations, like let's say the COVID vaccine is mandated, and it's not a state statute. It's just like, let's say, I probably shouldn't use this, but it's Alaska Airlines and Pfizer. And I guess I don't want to be told that I can't fly because they have some sort of agreement that everybody who flies on their airline has to have the Pfizer vaccine. So,
Senator, I guess the question needs to be more relevant to his role on the medical board.
I am. I'm getting ready. Okay. I was getting to that. So I guess where I was going with this is that I just want the legislative body. Would you agree that the legislative body regarding state statutes need to be the law of the land, and that you would honor the statutes as a member of the board in regards to this? And so basically the legislative body, not the corporate people, are making laws in regards to our individual rights.
So reading through the state medical statutes, it is my understanding the state medical board takes the legislation that you guys produce, and then we create policy that is consistent with the letter and the intent of the legislation. And so, as I understand it, we create policy that is consistent with the legislation that you guys produce.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. At this time, we're going to open up your any other questions, Mr. Wilson? Seeing none, we're going to open public testimony. Anyone here in the room in Juneau like to testify on Captain Wilson's appointment? Seeing none, we do have one person online, Mr. Ed Martin. If you are online, if you can put yourself on the record and plan for about 2 minutes for your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Wilson, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Wilson. My name is Ed Martin, Jr. I'm 67 years old. I'm a 56-year Alaska resident. I live and reside normally in Kenai, Alaska. I'm calling you from the Paradise Islands of Hawaii. I don't know David Wilson that well, but one thing I do know, that he's in the private sector, and he's not necessarily, may have some credentials. I think I've read through some of his resume, although most of it's blocked out. I don't know if I could call him and actually talk to him. It would be nice to talk to the person that's going to, you know, govern over the medical professionals of our state. So, you know, there could be a follow-up where he could return a call to me at some point in time. I am a patient with the Alaska State Providence Heart Institute. I've got 6 stents in my heart. I currently have a blocked carotid artery between 70% and 90%. I'm in Hawaii, and there's no way in heck I would go to a hospital here. I'm not certain I would go to hospitals in Alaska, and I'm not certain that I would even go to anybody that's recommended by a physician currently. About a year ago, Mr. Wilson, and this is something that I'm concerned about, I went to my heart doctor. I asked him to prescribe me hydroxychloroquine. He wouldn't do it. I asked about ivermectin. He wouldn't do it. This is a man that I've put trust in for my existence in some degree. It was over 2 years before I even got back to actually see him last summer.
Mr. Martin, do you have any input on whether or not you would like to see David Wilson confirmed to the state medical board?
Well, at this point in time, from the testimony and the few questions that you legislators asked of him, which may not be pertinent enough for my concerns, okay. That's the only information I can get on this guy.
Okay, so Mr. Martin,
members of this committee, I have the right to privacy, and I think quite often the doctors we have in our profession today do not observe that. They further
Mr. Martin,
do not prescribe when they should.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And for other folks in the public, for conferees, if you do have questions or concerns, I would suggest you reach out to your state house and state senate representatives, that they may be able to ask some of these questions on your behalf. for that, or if you know these individuals personally, you can do that. But the information is protective because they are not on the board yet. And if they are served on the board, you may be able to reach out to those boards and commission director to maybe ask those questions through their office, through the governor's office, through the boards and commissions director. That information can be found on the state's website at alaska.gov. At this time, we'll recognize Senator Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, before you do that, I just want to thank both of these gentlemen for stepping up, and also there were good questions, good discussion, and a special thanks to Captain Wilson from Palmer for stepping up. And so with that, Mr. Chair, in accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Health and Social Services Committee reviewed the following and recommends appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. State Medical Board, Matt Halala, David Wilson. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions.
All right. With that, we'll take a breather IDs to sign the letter and allow Senator Begich and his trusted staff, Ms. Loki Tobin, to come on up to ready to present SB 74. We're at ease. We are back on the record. Next, we do have Senate Bill 184, Settlement, Trust, and Benefits and Eligibility. At the table, we do have Senator Begich and Ms. Tobin from his office here to present this bill. When you guys are ready, feel free to put yourselves on the record and walk us through this piece of legislation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just, my name for the record is Tom Begich. I am the Senator for District J. Which is downtown Anchorage, includes Government Hill, Airport Heights, Mountain View, Fairview, and associated other areas, a little bit of Russian Jack. The reason that we're before you is to discuss very briefly Senate Bill 184, a fairly simple bill, fairly simple piece of legislation. And it really does come out of something that we're often used to here in this building. We receive personal requests for assistance, often from residents, constituents, based on their hardships or their experiences. Many of the smaller pieces of legislation that fill our statute books come from these inadvertent things, these unintended consequences of various laws. In this case, we received a request from our congressional delegation, from Kelly Cordelia and Senator Murkowski's office, who had received a note from a member of my constituency, a Mountain View resident. And it was really to address an issue that may only in the end affect a handful of folks, but it has a disproportional effect on those people. SB 184 is a bill that would address how benefits or distributions that are a result of the settlement trust, like the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, will affect an Alaska Native or their descendants' eligibility for other state and federal services. Part of the settlement of ANCSA included distributions or benefits to the enrolled tribal members at the time, 1971, and compensates them for their portion of historic land ownership and recognizes that financial resources may be needed to preserve indigenous cultures and ensure Alaska Natives and their descendants are able to contribute to live, continue to live in indigenous communities. Distributions of those ANCSA settlements are meant to compensate Alaska Natives and their descendants for this indigenous land claim settlement. And they're separate from other benefits that an individual may receive due to disability or age, many of which we have dealt with in this committee and are familiar with. Unfortunately, the way the law is currently written does not guarantee that an Alaska Native can and will receive the distribution as well as the other benefits that are due to them as Alaskans due to certain qualifying circumstances. The constituent reached out, and I believe we've included the letter with their permission in the packet under supporting documents, and you can take a look at it. James Chakwa is the constituent. He's an enrolled member of the Old Harbor Corporation, which is a tribal entity, a tribal corporation down in Kodiak Island, and he's been declining any of the benefits that are due him from the settlement because they put him just barely over the federal income limits for Medicaid. And after experiencing a life-changing event where his wife went through a $300,000 open-heart surgery that was covered by Medicaid, he's very concerned of personally losing that coverage over time, so he neglects the benefit. Sometimes the benefit margin is just a few pennies. Sometimes it's $100, $150 over the limit, something like that. What this bill does is it seeks by statute to exclude certain payments for these disabled Alaska Natives or their descendants from being used to determine eligibility for public assistance, senior benefits, and the Pioneer's Home. This is based on a similar bill, S-2524, that's currently in the United States Senate. That was introduced on July 28th of last year, and that would do exactly this, exclude that interest or distribution for a settlement trust for an Alaska Native or descendant of an Alaska Native who is aged, blind, or disabled from eligibility for certain programs like Medicaid. It's currently being considered in the U.S. Congress. Senator Murkowski's office has indicated that it has bipartisan support. It's likely to pass. What this bill says is that if it does pass, we'll be able to immediately have a statute in the books that makes it relevant. In other words, if that bill doesn't pass, then the statute would effectively not take effect, but would be able to take effect right away instead of having the few people it would impact have to wait until the next time we're together to have it take effect. With that, if there are any questions, I'm happy to try to answer them. Again, this legislation anticipates the passage of S-2524 and ideally prepares the state for that change. So it's really in advance of when it would be needed, but precisely so we can take advantage of that federal legislation immediately, should it pass. If there are any questions, we do have the Director of Public Assistance online. We've talked about it briefly with the Assistant Commissioner of Health and Social Services and some of their senior staff. And if there are no questions, my aide Luki Tobin will read you the sectional analysis.
Before we go through questions, let's go ahead and do the sectional first.
Okay.
For the record, Luki Tobin, staff to Senator Begich, I will be reading a sectional analysis of Senate Bill 184, version 32-LS-1473, version A. So Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 47.25.435. This section is pertaining to adult of public assistance. Changes in this section exclude any interest or distribution from a settlement trust made to an Alaska Native or their descendant who is age, blind, or disabled, as defined by U.S. Code 42-1382C, subsection A1. Section 2 inserts a new subsection under Alaska Statute 47.45.302. This section is pertaining to Senior Benefits Payment Program. Changes made to this section exclude from calculations of household income any interest or distribution from a settlement trust made to an Alaska Native or their descendant who is aged, blind, or disabled, as defined by 42 U.S. Code 1382, Section C, subsection A1. Section 3 amends Alaska Statute 47.55.020. This is pertaining to Alaska Pioneers Homes and Alaska Veterans Homes. This amendment section inserts a new subsection to exclude any interest or distribution from a settlement trust to an Alaska Native or their descendant who is aged, blind, or disabled, as defined by 42 U.S. Code 1382C, subsection A1. For reference, this U.S. Code defines eligibility requirements for those who are aged, blind, and disabled.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may. Senator Begich, for the record, I misspoke. Cordelia Kelly, not Kelly Cordelia. I got her name backwards just because of the way we write these emails. So I apologize for that to both the committee and to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you. I think we have a question from Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. So I do not have the U.S. statutes. We have the state statutes, but I don't have the U.S. statutes. So if you could just please define what aged means in there, what disabled means, because there's thousands of ways you can be, you know, considered disabled, and I don't want a loophole. I want a sustainable long-term program. I want to know exactly what they define. Aged, blind is obvious, so you can skip that one.
For the record, Lukey Tobin, staff to Senator Begich. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, we can get that code for you. It's about 4 pages long in defining what an individual who is age disabled and blind happens to be. So it's a pretty comprehensive definition within U.S. code.
Yes, Senator Reinbold?
So there's not like 55 or whatever. It's much more complicated than that. I think that's really important because it's actually the meat of the bill. It's something that I need to be able to read.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Begich for the record, through the chair. Senator Reinbold, precisely why the code is so complex is to make sure, why it's so detailed is to make sure nobody slips through, you know, so that there's some like barn door open here. So we'll get that for the committee and we'll provide that to the committee so you have the direct detail of it and you'll see what the code actually defines. And that's why the federal law is you know, fairly clear on this matter.
And through the chair, thank you, because what I'm learning is there are thousands and thousands of ways you can be disabled. I didn't even know. I'm actually working with an ADA lawyer right now, and I just had no idea how broad this was, and that's why I don't want to make a grand door, you know, for this, because we're never going to have a sustainable program if everybody can slip through. Blind, I absolutely understand that. I think those people need VIP care. It's really challenging, but I do think it's critical to know what kind of disabled and what kind of age there is, because Medicaid expansion, my opinion, has diluted the program so severely that it's not sustainable and it will not be around for long if we continue with Medicaid expansion. We must repeal that. But I understand this is a different, but I thank you for getting that information. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes.
For the committee, we'll provide a copy of the actual S-2524, which is Senator Murkowski's bill. And this on its page 2, line 9, 10, and 11, literally does say, as defined in section 1614A of the Social Security Act, and then listed, so we'll get that to you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Casella.
Thank you. My question has to do with the section related to the Pioneer Home Statute, which is 4755020. It's page 2, starting on lines 12. Was there any thought put into whether or not these hold harmless provisions would apply to any Alaskan who's in a home or just those in a Pioneer home?
Lukey Tobin, staff to Senator Begich, through the chair, Senator Costello. In alignment with a request made from Senator Murkowski, we were excluding state-funded programs and not necessarily extending the purview of the piece of legislation.
So I have a poll. So this just applies to an individual in a Pioneer home. No other home or living environment. So if a person is in a Pioneer home, then their additional settlement trust or benefits, because they're Alaska Native, would be hold them harmless from their benefits. But if an individual is in a private home or some other home, that they are not having this particular portion of the bill affect them.
Through the chair, Senator Begich for the record. Senator Costello, it's because the Pioneer Home has a unique relationship with the state as a state benefit. That's why it's included. It would, for Medicaid benefits, if indeed a person was receiving Medicaid benefits to be in another private home or another home. In other words, if Medicaid was paying for part of that private benefit and the eligibility of the individual were to exceed the amount to be eligible for Medicaid, they would lose the Medicaid benefit and consequently not be able to use the Medicaid benefit for that home, and they'd be out of that home anyway. So it actually does affect the private homes you're talking about, but it does so because it says if indeed you lose your Medicaid benefit and it's what's paying for the private home, this would hold you harmless from losing the Medicaid benefit. So the Pioneer Home has a unique relationship with the state outside of the Medicaid benefit. And so, yeah, we've debated in this committee and in other committees the nature of how that benefit is applied. You know, the Pioneer Home has different tiers of beneficiaries. So what we're trying to do with the Pioneer Home piece here is make sure that you don't get knocked up into a higher tier that you would otherwise be knocked into. That's the only reason it's in here separately is because of that specific nature of it. So repeating again, the Medicaid payment that is used to pay for an individual's private home experience, if indeed they have that private private senior home experience, could be lost if they exceed the limit. And this is just providing that extra, if you will, cushion so that if they receive a historic payment based on the ANCSA Act of 1971, that it wouldn't knock them out of that Medicaid eligibility, which would then take them away from that private home. So it's not saying only one type of home. It's acknowledging the unique relationship to the individual of the Pioneer's Home's tiered status.
Thank you. I have a question for Director O'Brien, and then Senator Hughes has a question. Director O'Brien, do you have an estimate number of Alaskans that this may affect?
For the record, this is Shonda O'Brien, Director of Public Assistance. Mr. Chair, we do not have that data available to us at this point in time. We're looking to see if there's a way for us to extract detail that would give us an idea, but the system doesn't have the capability to identify resources and income of the recipients of the programs in a way that we can ask it to tell us how many might not be eligible as a result. Typically, eligibility is determined, you know, at the point of application or recertification for the programs, and that information is not currently being collected.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Well, mine was along the very same lines because of the age. If we were just talking about blind and disabled, it'd be a very small number, as you mentioned, Senator Begich. But because it's anyone, I believe, age 65 or over, I'm guessing, it could be quite a few. And it sounds like the department doesn't have that, but I'm wondering if we could get some kind of estimate. Maybe working with the Department of Labor and the statistics as far as income levels, because I think this could be quite a few. And since we have expanded Medicaid, that's always been my concern, is it could crowd out the elderly and the truly vulnerable people who need help. And I do know that people that are able-bodied and of working age sometimes do need a bit of a safety net, but when it's ongoing and it crowds out the elderly, it's very concerning. So I know we're not the finance committee, but I think we need to know accurately, are we talking about, you know, 20 people a year? Are we talking about hundreds? And so I think that's important information to have, because everybody, you know, most of us will grow old and hit that 65, and that's the case with Alaska Natives. So this really could be an increased cost, and I know that the bill hasn't passed. So I would like your office and maybe with the department to try to get some estimates for us, even though they don't have anything right now to pull up. And then I have the question that I just had just departed my brain. So
I'll give you a chance, perhaps. As Senator,
it was unrelated to that. But
Senator Begich, for the record, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, you've asked precisely the question we asked the department, which is how many do you think that this would cover? Our belief is it will cover actually very few people. However, I'm also going to inquire from Senator Murkowski's office that same question, because they will have done some of the data on this as well. So there may be a way between our inquiry of the Department of Health and Social Services and our inquiry of Senator Murkowski's office that we'll be able to discover what that roundabout number is. I think we were, you know, this bill was just introduced. We're very thankful to have a chance to have a hearing on the bill. What I'm hopeful is that we can get those answers to you very, very quickly.
Excellent.
Senator Hughes?
The one that departed my brain landed again, and it is actually the bill in Congress. You mentioned that there seemed to be some bipartisan support, but do we have any idea of the likelihood of how that might progress and when that might progress? I know that's a tough thing. You know, we have, I don't know, probably 700, 800 bills in this building. Very few will will pass, and I know it's even more so at the congressional level. So what is the likelihood in the timeline that you're hearing?
Thank you. Tom Begich for the record, Tom Begich, State Senator for District J, through the chair. Senator Hughes, that's actually one of those things you can't actually get a feeling for in D.C. You know, it's been wrapped around the axle up there for quite some time, or down there for quite some time. But when you see a bill move in committee, especially on the Senate side where there's such divisiveness, that's generally a sign that a bill has a chance of passage. When you see it move through committee without amendment, it's also generally a sign that it's moving toward passage. So this bill was passed out on February 10th from the committee, which is why I believe it was brought to our attention, because they felt the wheels were getting greased, as it were. It was reported by Mr. Manchin, who's the chair of that committee, without amendment. So that, to us, seems to indicate that this bill is on a fast track for passage. And so with that in mind, we've decided we needed to put this bill in to anticipate its passage.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
And then just a technical, and you maybe said this in your introduction, and if you did, I apologize, I didn't catch it. If this were to pass at the federal level, is it necessary for it to pass at the state level in order for aged, blind, or disabled Alaska Native to take advantage of it? Or if it passes at the federal level, are we good to go?
Senator Begich, for the record, through the chair, Senator Hughes, we believe, based on the correspondence with Senator Murkowski's office and our contact with them, that the answer is yes to your question, that we need to have the bill passed at the local level to take advantage of the change at the federal level.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the bill sponsor?
Well, thank you, Senator Begich. And, you know, for that number, I would need that number to feel a little bit more comfortable personally, just to vote for this bill on final passage if it makes it that far through the process. I just want to make sure we're not talking about, we're talking tens and twenties, or we're talking about thousands. Makes a huge difference to that. But with that, I'll let you do any final, your final closing statements.
Yeah, Senator Tom Begich, for the record, Mr. Chairman, I would not want to pass a bill that it didn't have a number for either, at least an estimate, which is what we're hoping for, which is thank you for the hearing, because the hearing has brought it to the attention of the department, which was able to begin preparing, you know, and beginning to examine those questions. And so you and I share the same concern. The idea is to find the number, ensure that we know what that number is, ensure that we can afford that number, ensure that we then are providing the best services we can for Alaska. So I will be looking for that number to provide you as well.
Yes.
You know, that was supposed to be his final statement, but I'll just say I would actually, because I do believe elderly people are a vulnerable population, and constitutionally we have an obligation. If it were in the thousands, if we would roll back Medicaid expansion, then I could be okay with the thousands, Mr. Chair. But I do agree it's going to be important to know what the impact of this is. Thank you.
With that, we will open public testimony on Senate Bill 184. Anyone here in the room in Juneau want to testify? Seeing none, and no one here online, we will close public testimony at this time. We will set this bill aside and ask committee members if there are amendments, if they could send them to Ledge Legal and notify our office by 5 p.m. on Monday, February 21st. Our next committee meeting will be Tuesday, the 22nd, where we will consider the appointment of Kevin Finman to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Board of Trustees, and Senate Bill 169, the Smoke, Fire, Damper, Smoke Control Systems, by Senator Costello. By that concludes our committee this afternoon. Any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 2:36 p.m.